You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, President Trump canceled a trip to Denmark after the country's prime minister refused to talk about the prospect of selling Greenland. We'll find out more during our weekly roundup of national politics. First, one of the big changes in the American economy in recent decades has been a transition away from the dominance of large-scale manufacturing. A lot of our economy now is driven by providing services, from the waiter who brings us our food to the programmer who works on the technology for our phone. As that part of the economy changes, the idea of what makes an economy competitive is changing too. Tessa Conroy is an economic development specialist and an assistant professor at UW-Madison and Extension. She recently analyzed the competitiveness of Wisconsin's economy in a paper for the Center for Community and Economic Development at UW-Madison. Tessa, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure to be chatting with you.
Well, tell us about this report. You're trying to gauge competitiveness of states, including Wisconsin, in a different way than we might think of in the past.
That's right. So in the past, we used to think of competitiveness a little bit differently. So kind of coming out of the post-war era, we had a lot of big manufacturing, and we thought of competitiveness as the regions that were most amenable to those types of businesses, and that had a lot to do with pursuing low-cost strategies, so low taxes, inexpensive labor as examples. But the economy has really changed. We have more services than we used to. Our manufacturing is a lot leaner. We're also seeing that people kind of prefer to live in these high amenity places. They're thinking a lot more about quality of life. So now when we think about competitiveness, we think about a lot more than just business costs. We think about innovation, and we think about natural amenities and quality of life. We think about the human capital of a region, for example.
Yeah, one thing that struck me is the idea in your report that in the past we might think, okay, people go to jobs. Now we're seeing more and more employers going toward people.
Right. So we used to think exactly that people follow jobs. So sort of kind of build the business community and the people will come. And now we're leaning more and focusing more on kind of how jobs follow people. So if we can attract the people to our region because we have a desirable community, a desirable region, it has green space and good infrastructure and schools and libraries, people are going to want to come live there. And more employers are seeking out the right labor pool for their business. So kind of the business, the people come and then the businesses come.
Now, if I'm writing a state by state report of business competitiveness, doing it the old way is kind of easy peasy. I look at the tax rate. I find out how much you have to pay to hire somebody, maybe the cost of land. Boom, there's my report. How do you start to gauge these things that are in ways more intangible?
Right. So now it's, I would say, a more holistic approach to competitiveness. So rather than just thinking about costs, those are still important, but so are a lot of other factors. So one structure that we use in community development is to think about community capitals. So the more obvious of those might be human capital and financial capital, for example. So kind of what's the skill level in your community? What do the education and training opportunities look like as far as financial capital, thinking about the capacity for a region to generate wealth, for their ability to finance new investments? But beyond that, it's also social capital and natural capital, cultural capital. How do we recognize and celebrate the heritage of our residents? How do we incorporate the diversity of our community? It's political capital, kind of who has decision-making power and what are the participatory processes like? And also the built capital, so kind of coming back to infrastructure. So you could really think about kind of a broad set of indicators that would lead to a more competitive region. That's how we would think about it today.
Talking to Tessa Conroy from UW-Madison and Extension, looking at a new report gauging the competitiveness of Wisconsin's economy using different measures than you might think of in the past. Tessa, you used a handful of different measures. First of all, what kind of things did Wisconsin come out looking pretty good in compared to other states?
So, you know, for example here, let me start with the things we looked at. So we looked at patents, we looked at R&D spending, we looked at PhDs awarded and broadband coverage. So these are kind of all different things that are maybe a little bit broader, again, than just looking at costs. When we combined all of these factors, Wisconsin came out about 21st. So kind of in the middle of the pack when we, you know, combine these various aspects of competitiveness, but unfortunately relatively low for the region. So when you look at our neighboring states, we're the lowest kind of between Minnesota and Illinois, and again, those neighboring states.
Of those measures, did we come out higher in than maybe the average?
So unfortunately, our highest rank is total crime rate. So 13th for total crime rate. So that's actually one of the things that we looked at that we would actually expect to be kind of negative related to competitiveness. So we wanted to look at both sides of the coin. Mm-hmm. But that could be a number of factors. Some people kind of point to struggles in Milwaukee, but it's also northern Wisconsin where we have some kind of high property crimes based on the recreational housing there. But some other places where we did quite well are the total patents per 10,000. So that's a good thing that kind of speaks to the innovative capacity of the state. And we also did relatively well at 18th with PhDs awarded in the state. So kind of in the better half there in terms of overall state rankings.
On the other hand, one of the measures you mentioned, broadband access, we don't look so good compared to the rest of the country.
Right. So broadband coverage, we say we have 85, maybe almost 86% broadband coverage in the state, and that might sound like a lot, but it's really not compared to other states. We rank 35th on broadband coverage. So that can be really limiting, especially for our most rural communities. That's limiting for people in their personal lives at home, but also limiting for businesses and entrepreneurs who kind of rely on the internet for access to markets, for example. They're not just selling locally. They want to reach a broader consumer base.
Now, one thing you did interesting in this report was take each of your measures and do kind of a check. How do these things correlate with economic performance in states? One that struck me is that one of the things you measured was taxes per person, I think. And you found a correlation between tax levels and economic performance. Not what people might have expected, though.
Right. So we actually found that when we look at how the taxes are related to gross state products, so kind of just a measure of the size of our economy, that those are actually positive correlated. So some of the economies that are doing better also have higher taxes. And we wouldn't expect that based on past measures of or the way we used to think about competitiveness. So it kind of seems to be the case that, like, well, as I was saying earlier, that costs aren't the only thing that matters. In fact, just based on this sort of simple correlation, it's not the case that taxes are really predicting who's going to have the strongest economy at the state level.
Let's talk about what a policymaker might do with this. And getting back to those ideas of the different kinds of capital, not just economic, but your report mentions natural capital, you know, taking advantage of scenic beauty to lure people to work there, social capital, built capital. What kind of things can communities try to develop, promote, build on to attract business in this new model?
So I think one of the strengths for Wisconsin is our natural capital. It's a beautiful state. We have a lot of lakeshore property, for example. So in terms of, you know, thinking about how can we get people to move to Wisconsin, I think protecting and marketing that natural capital that we have in so many of our communities is one advantage. How do we make the most of those natural assets that we have? And then when people do come from different communities from other places, thinking about social and cultural capital, how do we welcome people? How do we integrate newcomers into our communities? At the local level, some community development strategies, we would say kind of inclusive community development or age inclusive even. That's one example. So we have in Wisconsin some kind of recent retirees that like to move here. Maybe they're moving to their lakeshore property, for example. So thinking about how do we incorporate this demographic into our community, this group that has, you know, a lot of experience. Hopefully they've had the opportunity to accumulate some financial capital, this spirit of civic engagement and volunteerism. So these can all be strengths for our local community development efforts.
Sounds like there might not be a one-size-fits-all approach for all communities. They're going to have different demographics, different natural environments, different downtowns. So it sounds like it takes a little more thoughtful local process.
Definitely. It's about local assets and recognizing, identifying what you have, what you can work with, thinking about your business community as well. Every business kind of industry might think about different comparative advantage and be seeking different aspects of these capitals. So when you're thinking about how do we support our local businesses with the assets that we have, how do we attract people with the assets that we have, that's certainly going to vary community by community.
Tessa, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
That was Tessa Conroy, Economic Development Specialist and Assistant Professor at UW-Madison and Extension. She was with us today to talk about how competitive Wisconsin's economy is and how we measure economic opportunities in the modern economy. Coming up after the news, President Trump said he was considering a payroll tax cut. That's coming up a little later. We'll check in on that and other stories in our look at the week in Washington. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, it's our weekly look at some of the top stories in national politics. First, almost half the field of Democratic candidates for president were in Iowa this week for a forum spotlighting Native American issues. That included Senator Elizabeth Warren, who apologized publicly for having previously identified herself as having Native American heritage.
I am sorry for harm I have caused. I have listened and I have learned a lot. And I am grateful for the many conversations that we've had together. It is a great honor to be able to partner with Indian Country. And that's what I've tried to do as a senator. And that's what I promise I will do as president of the United States of America.
Just prior to attending the forum, Warren unveiled several policy proposals aimed at helping Native American communities. Forrest Funmaker is the public relations officer for the Ho-Chunk Nation. He attended the event in Iowa this week. Forrest, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, why did you decide to go to Iowa and check out what these candidates had to say?
Well, looking at what's happening in Milwaukee next year, I know the president, White Eagle, who's newly into his administration, wanted to make sure he had a good look at what the candidates are going to bring. One of the background people that is working with the Democratic Party wanted us to then go out to the Frank Lemire occasion and then to assess what is going on with each and every one of the candidates that did attend. And so his analysis was that there were hardly any Native Americans being hired into these particular campaigns to be writers of policy that would affect Indian Country in any kind of way. So that was part of the process that we wanted to see, and then to also meet some of the candidates and what did they have to offer.
Now, this forum was targeting issues of interest to Native Americans. Is this unusual? Do we usually not see even that much attention paid to Native Americans when it comes to a presidential race?
Especially with voter suppression going on and the remnants, how that's used across the country. But what was demonstrated there at the forum was that there are approximately 20 states that are bubble states that could go either way. And so the call to action for Indian Country and all of the different tribes was to go back, feed the people with the campaign to get out and vote to address the inconsistencies that are going on with the voting process, and then to be able to get enough people to hopefully tip the scales in favor of Native policy.
You mentioned, even though they were talking about Native policy, you didn't see a lot of Native policy makers on the staff of the candidates. Is that something you could see, you would hope to see politicians of both parties do, not just talk to Native Americans, but have Native Americans on the staff to help develop these policies?
Yeah, definitely there needs to be an increase of these particular candidates reaching out to Indian Country because, you know, as you may or may not know, there are a lot of smart Native Americans or American Indians across the country at all sorts of different levels. They could be able to influence policy. And, you know, going back to a lot of the things that do resonate, I think what comes down to is what we're looking at in terms of corporate interests, super PACs, and then how does that affect the voice of Native America?
What kind of issues do you want to hear candidates for president talking about when it comes to things that affect Native Americans and everyone else for that matter?
Well, definitely what we're looking at locally with the Ho-Chunk Nation is a feat of trust process. I think what we've had to deal with in Wisconsin, as you see the Ho-Chunk Nation in its history over the past 300 years, they've lost possibly about 33 million acres here in Wisconsin. And then there's other states as well that we're not federally recognized in, which includes Minnesota, Iowa, Missouri, and Illinois. And so, you know, our contingent is that we would like to not only be able to get those lands back that were taken from us, but also to then have a an ability to tax those lands and then to be able to work with local corporations, companies, or whatever, governments, to be able to have an economic development base for all of our tribal members. And a lot of our tribal members now are across the United States. So I think we have tribal members in 47 states.
Talking to Forrest Funmaker, public relations officer for the Ho-Chunk Nation. He attended an event in Iowa this week where about half of the many Democratic presidential candidates talked about issues of interest to Native Americans around the country. Forrest, closer to home, I want to talk about issues important to you at the Ho-Chunk Nation. What are some priorities for you here in the state?
Well, yeah, so we have a couple different irons in the fire, so to speak. We have the compact negotiations that may start up with how we deal with a project in Beloit, Wisconsin, and how that might look with the new industry that's going on in Illinois with the hemp and the legalization they've had there, how that will affect tribal lands. I think agriculture is another thing that we would like to get into, seeing if there's any returns that we could get from a business point of view. And language, our language just recently went through a really unique process, which was a rapid word project where we tried to get our elders to speak as many of the words that they still remember and put those down for us so that we could increase our dictionary from about 6,000 words to 20, and so 20,000 words. So that was an ambitious project still going on, and the implementation is to save our language so that we can use it for future endeavors. And, you know, one of the things, I guess, is that we're trying to get back to standards that we once knew for our people, but also to then have the economic development ability to get into a diversification model that would be beneficial to all of our communities. Of course, you know, all of our communities are battling some of the opioids that, you know, mainstream has to deal with as well. So we're trying to attack those problems locally with our law enforcement from a cultural standpoint. How do we introduce different models into our court processes? So these are all unique kind of things that were once done and now need to be kind of codified in some sort of new way so that they can be understood. And then, of course, economic development and Native tourism. How do we attract people to visit our lands and to get to know our people? Because it seems like we want to break down any of those barriers that people have, but also to introduce them to the beautiful world that we see here in Wisconsin and or our traditional territories in any one of the states that are here.
And Forrest, at the outset, you mentioned concerns about voter suppression. How do you see that happening with Native Americans in Wisconsin in particular?
Well, I think there's a disenfranchisement, you know, in terms of what the candidates really offer to natives across the board. And so, you know, I think for a majority of us that, you know, have a socialistic type of viewpoint, or those that have the more of the Republican viewpoint, you know, the nation, the Ho-Chunk Nation, has had to remain bipartisan in how it approaches that, because we have such a wide variety of our own people who vote in both parties or whatever party they want to vote in. So we have to respect that of our tribal membership. And then I guess, you know, to get them to be a part of the process, is this a two-party process? And do we have somebody like a Mark Charles, who is a mixed Navajo candidate, being able to get any play, or any of the people of color? Are they going to get any of the play? You know, so and so, do they even support Native Americans on any of our issues? And I've seen Cory Booker over at Sac and Fox in Tama, Iowa. See Mary Ann Williamson there, and it seems like, you know, there is a credibility that both the candidates want to apply and use to differentiate themselves.
And that's all the time we have. Thanks to Forrest Funmaker, public relations officer for the Ho-Chunk Nation, looking back at a candidate forum targeting Native American issues this week in Iowa. Stick around, there's more to come on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, after an explosion in Russia that killed 7 people, American intelligence officials suspect the source was a prototype of a new kind of nuclear missile. We'll talk about what's known so far and fears of a new arms race. First, we take a look at the week's news out of Washington. President Trump criticized any Jewish Americans who cast their votes for Democratic candidates. Presidential candidate Elizabeth Warren announced a plan to repeal key parts of the 1994 crime bill. And after teasing the idea of a payroll tax cut, President Trump said today it's no longer on the table. Our question for you this week: do you feel confident about the economy right now, or are you worried about a possible recession? Has the ongoing trade war with China affected your job or business? What does a healthy economy look like to you? What action, if any, do you want to see from the government? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Ginger Gibson is a political correspondent at Reuters. Ginger, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me back.
A lot going on. We'll put our seatbelts on, Ginger, and get rolling here. Let's start with Israel's decision. This seems like a long time ago now, to ban 2 Democratic representatives, Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar, from visiting the country. Tlaib was offered entry on humanitarian grounds. She declined that. Here she is speaking at a press conference on Monday.
Earlier this month, in fact, 71 other members of Congress traveled to Israel seemingly without incident. What is not common occurrence is members of Congress being barred from entering a country on these fact-finding missions unless they agree to strict set of rules curtailing their rights or being required to submit their itineraries for stop-by-stop pre-approval.
What else did Representatives Tlaib and Omar focus on at that press conference, Ginger?
You know, this press conference was, you're right, is sort of the latest, or not even the latest, but
right,
one of the latest iterations in this ongoing fight in which they tried to travel to Israel and were denied entry. But they were only denied entry after President Trump called Benjamin Netanyahu, the prime minister there, to turn them away. So a bit of a saga. They got up at this press conference and they said that this was an example of them being treated differently than other members of Congress because of their religion, because of the opinions that they hold, because they have been critical of President Trump. And Trump, of course, responded in his own way on Twitter, becoming more critical of both Congresswomen in this ongoing fight. And then, as you said, his remarks about whether or not Jewish people vote for him.
Right. Let's take it to there now. President Trump then has tweeted and said aid to Israel should stay as it is, and had this remark about Jewish Americans who vote for Democrats.
Where has the Democratic Party gone? Where have they gone where they're defending these 2 people over the state of Israel? And I think any Jewish people that vote for a Democrat, I think it shows either a total lack of knowledge or great disloyalty.
And that's been repeated in print and said out loud, disloyalty. Do we know who President Trump was suggesting those voters were being disloyal to?
He was actually asked on Wednesday who they were being disloyal to, and he said Israel. This was sort of the same comment that Representative Omar was criticized for making earlier this year, saying that Jewish people had divided loyalties between the United States and Israel. And then Trump is saying that if you're Jewish, you have an obligation or a loyalty to Israel. So he has been heavily criticized in the wake of those remarks by this time, particularly Democrats. It was Republicans who criticized Representative Omar when she made those remarks, as well as Democrats. But in this case, Democrats criticizing President Trump for suggesting that there was some loyalty or obligation. And if you look at the voting numbers, something about 75% of America's Jewish population voted for Democrats in the last election. So that's a pretty sizable chunk of the electorate to be suggesting as either uninformed or disloyal to another country.
And part of the uproar over both Representative Omar's comments, as you mentioned, and President Trump's comments repeated over the last couple of days, this idea, this accusation of divided loyalty has often been used as part of anti-Semitic attacks here in the United States and around the world, for that matter, right?
That's right. So he is repeating a line that has been criticized, not in a sort of way to criticize that line, but really employing the same argument that he says others are being anti-Semitic and using themselves.
And the president retweeted tweets from Wayne Allen Root, known for promoting conspiracy theories, talking about people in Israel thinking of Trump as the king of Israel, the second coming of God. President Trump has gotten criticism for forwarding that. It's kind of weird in Jewish theology statements slash maybe offensive in Jewish theology. I can't speak to that. It's an odd retweet.
It was a very odd decision. It wasn't even a retweet. He was quoting from him. He typed the words out himself.
That's right.
So this wasn't just a hit the retweet button. I mean, he repeated the words. And you're right, calling himself the king, essentially appearing to call himself the king of Israel, or to quote someone calling him the king of Israel, was really surprising. And again, critics said inappropriate, not a line. I, like you, I'm not sure on the specifics of the Jewish teachings. I wouldn't pretend to be, but this has prompted a lot of criticism that he was being inconsiderate. And you know, we see records of Trump, people who praise Trump get Trump's praise and get Trump's repeating of those praises, even when the praise feels a little bit inappropriate, and that this may be another case of that.
Talking to Ginger Gibson, political correspondent at Reuters, looking at some of the top stories in national politics. A lot of focus moving on, Ginger, to the economy this week. Concerns, President Trump says the economy is good, but he's worried about actions at the Fed. He wants maybe some preventive action for a recession. And we have this timeline, reports that the Trump administration is considering a temporary payroll tax cut. Correct me if I don't have this right. Denial from a White House spokesperson that they were doing that. Then President Trump says, yes, we're considering that. And then today, President Trump says they aren't considering it. Is that the latest on the idea of a payroll tax cut?
That is the latest. You've summed up what is a pretty scattered shot.
That's all in the last 2-3 days, too, right?
It's all in like the last 24 hours that we've heard the president move all over the place on the issue of the payroll tax. And look, the payroll tax is a tax cut that's used really in times of economic concern to juice the economy. There was a payroll tax holiday implemented by President Obama when he took office in 2008 in the wake of the Great Recession, and it was done to put money in the pockets of middle class and lower middle class consumers to try to get the economy moving. Changing this tax would be viewed by economic forecasters, by people in the markets, as an attempt to help rescue the economy. So the president keeps insisting there's no worry, nothing to see here, everything is fine, the economy is fine. And then this mixed message on whether or not they need to do something to sort of juice the economy is creating a bit of a schizophrenic message out of the White House.
And the president has also consistently said the Federal Reserve should do more. They should bring down the interest rates. And I've seen some economists on both sides of this saying, yeah, if we were worried about a recession, this might not be such a bad idea. The president has continued pretty steadily his criticism of Jerome Powell, the chair of the Fed.
He has. This morning he tweeted that Jerome Powell was like a golfer who couldn't putt. He had no touch. That was a pretty distinctive Trumpian insult for someone to sort of insult them as a bad golfer. But he has been consistently attacking Powell. He really thinks that Powell should be driving those interest rate numbers down, and that his refusal to do so is just the reason that anyone would be concerned about the economy.
And then in a kind of sprawling press availability today, talking about a lot of different issues, the president also addressed the tariff and trade war with China. He briefly referred to himself as the chosen one when it came to renegotiating trade policy with China. What does he have to say about the impact of this trade battle?
You know, two things I'm hearing from the White House, in addition to what President Trump said and talking to sources close to the White House, is that the president's very worried about what China is going to do to our economy. So if there is a concern, it's someone else's fault, and it's someone else's fault other than the Fed, maybe China. He's worried that the protests in Hong Kong have made it difficult for him to negotiate with China, and that the continued fight over this trade deal could cause problems. But we heard him say today, as you mentioned, that he's not ready to make a deal, that he's not there yet, and that he thinks that it needs to be a good deal before he strikes it. So further signs that we're a long way from ending this trade war.
Talking to Ginger Gibson, correspondent at Reuters, about some of the week's news in national politics. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. As we heard, President Trump teased the idea of a payroll tax cut, took it off the table. He also criticized the Federal Reserve. How do you feel about the economy and where it's going? Do you worry about a potential recession? Do you think the government or the Federal Reserve should do something to juice the economy, prevent that recession? Is the ongoing trade war with China affecting you in your line of work? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Ginger Gibson, political correspondent at Reuters, looking at the week's top news out of Washington. We were just talking about the economy, what President Trump has had to say the last couple of days. Let's bring on a caller now. Patricia is with us in Madison. Patricia, hi.
Hi there. It's ironic how he's criticizing Jerome Powell now for not lowering the Fed interest rates. He had criticized Janet Yellen, who had been the chairman, because she wasn't raising them fast enough. She kept them low, and he wanted her to increase them, and he didn't appoint her to a second term as Fed chair, so he appointed Jerome Powell. Now, you know, it's just the opposite.
Patricia, thanks for the call. I don't remember that line of argument on Janet Yellen. Ginger, off the top of my head, do you?
Yes, the president, before he took office, was quite critical of Yellen, argued that she should have been drastically increasing the rates and that she wasn't increasing them fast enough as a favor to President Obama, that he wasn't doing enough to improve the economy and that she shouldn't have been helping him. I think we see an example of where President Trump has really struggled to understand the confines of government. While the president appoints the Fed chairman, it is an independent agency. He doesn't get to tell them what to do. In his business background, if he had a head of his hotel division that he didn't like what they were doing, he could fire them. That's not the case when you're the president. Some agencies intentionally are set up to be outside the influence of politics, and the Fed is one of those. And we really see that frustration from the president playing out in all of these tweets and these complaints about the Fed chairman decisions.
Thanks for that call, Patricia. I want to take a couple more callers back to back. Jeremy is with us in Racine. Jeremy, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I believe we will be heading into a recession. When, I'm not exactly certain, but it's probably going to happen. But there's one other point I want to make. A lot of people are not talking enough about, I believe, is the demographics involved in our economy. We have a large population of baby boomers who are going to be retiring or have already retired, and that's going to put a lot of burden on the next generations to pick up the slack in 401k investments, things like that. It's going to be a lot of money not going into the stock markets and investments. It's going to be pulling out of that. So taxes are going to have to go up. It's going to change, and it's going to have an effect around the world. And I just wish politicians and people in power who are educating the public should really start talking about demographics and how it's going to play a role in the future.
Jeremy, thanks a lot for the call. We'll bring on Dan now in Green Bay. Dan, hi.
Yeah, hi. I've been in finance business for 25 years. I've rarely seen an economy that's strong in Wisconsin. There's jobs everywhere. Wages are going up. My kid just turned 17, and he had 7 job offers. He has people walking up to him at restaurants offering him a job, and he held out till he got $12 an hour. So whatever they're doing, I just hope they keep doing it. I do support, finally we're doing something about China taking our manufacturing jobs. I do support that, but the economy right now is rip-roaring in Green Bay.
Dan, thanks a lot for the call. A couple different perspectives there, Ginger. And, yeah, a lot of economists see a lot of bright sides and maybe some dark clouds behind the silver linings.
Yes, there are positive indicators of the economy right now. We see unemployment really low. We see continued growth, so we're not in a negative growth situation. I will say one thing about Wisconsin, and we see it in Wisconsin and a couple of other of sort of the lake or the north central states, which is there hasn't been an increase in manufacturing jobs. There's actually been a decrease. But one of the things, as your first caller pointed out, that's keeping the unemployment numbers really low is we see a workforce that's aging out and not being replaced. So unemployment's dropped because people are leaving the workforce. They're retiring, and there are less people, young people, behind them to replace it. So Wisconsin specifically, we've seen that phenomenon happening. There aren't more jobs in Wisconsin. There's just less people of working age to do the jobs that are there. And that has had positive influences on the economy, but as was pointed out, has some long-term risks when we don't have people paying into Social Security and we don't have people paying income taxes. And we could see stresses on our government coffers because of that.
Thanks for those calls. We're talking to Ginger Gibson from Reuters about some of the big news in national politics. Want to cover a couple other issues. Ginger, you wrote about this one. Senator Elizabeth Warren, a Democratic candidate for president, put out a plan that would repeal a lot of the 1994 crime bill. What kind of changes is she looking at there?
You know, Warren is really struggling to win African-American voters, and we see her trying to address issues that have been named as important by a significant number of Black or African-American voters. And this one, the issue of criminal justice reform is one of them. Now, the 1994 crime bill that you mentioned, this was a bill that Vice President Biden helped get passed when he was in the Senate, and a bill that has been heavily criticized for contributing to mass incarcerations, for unfairly treating Black individuals different than white individuals. So she wants to mostly do away with the entire law. Part of it was mandatory minimum sentences. If you were caught with drugs, you had to go to jail for a certain amount of time. She thinks the judges should have more decisions in those places.
And that's an issue that's come up a lot as we see conservative and liberal groups getting together to rethink our crime policies, these concerns over mandatory minimums and things like that. Is this something you see getting support among potentially a lot of Democratic primary voters?
Absolutely. This is an bipartisan issue. We have seen legislation move through Congress, maybe one of the only things that we've seen Congress do in the last couple of years on a bipartisan basis. But they did pass one overhaul earlier this year that President Trump signed into law. Democrats think there is more work to be done. So do some Republicans. And I think we're going to continue to see both sides talking about this issue.
And then President Trump canceled or at least indefinitely postponed a visit to the nation of Denmark because the country wasn't willing to sell or even talk about selling Greenland. What happened? What got us here?
This is one of the odder stories of the week. We learned last week that President Trump was interested in purchasing Greenland, and that he was looking at making this purchase. He then came out on Sunday and said that he was less interested in it, that it wasn't a number one priority. But when the head of Denmark, the Denmark Prime Minister, said that Greenland wasn't for sale, he canceled his meetings with her. And in a press conference on Wednesday, called her nasty for being so dismissive of his efforts to buy Denmark. So maybe it was a little bit more of a priority than he was originally letting on.
Greenland not for sale, apparently, though.
Not for sale, no.
Now, in the wake of mass shootings in El Paso and Dayton, President Trump said he was open to expanding background checks and strengthening red flag laws a few weeks later. What are we hearing now?
He initially said right after the shooting that he was interested in looking at some of the background check issues, some red flag issues, which directly associate with purchasing guns. He has moved away from that, said on Sunday that there were enough background checks. He repeated that again this week. And he called it a slippery slope, which his critics say is a sign that he's adopted the talking points of groups like the NRA. He said again today that there could be some background checks. Loopholes closed, but we're really a long way away in a short period of time from when he said in the initial aftermath of the shooting that he was willing to look at some changes to the background check laws.
Any action in the U.S. Senate on these issues?
Still a long way from any action in Congress. They're on their summer recess right now. They don't come back until September. Mitch McConnell has said he expects there to be discussions about background check laws. We know the House Democrats are coming back a little early to have a hearing, but we're still a long way away from any sign that they could pass a bill out of the Senate.
And speaking of the Senate, Ginger, you wrote about this, I think. A former Trump campaign manager, Corey Lewandowski, says he's considering a run for Senate in the state of New Hampshire. What are Republicans in New Hampshire in particular saying?
There's a bit of a civil war in New Hampshire over the possibility of Corey Lewandowski running from the Senate for the Senate. We talked to some folks there on the ground, and they tell me that he's a bit of a firebrand, which we already knew, but has some cross views with some folks who are, including the governor, who were sort of Republican mainstays there. And Democrats told me that they're not waiting to see how that Republican civil war plays out. They've been quite aggressive already in attacking Lewandowski. They're not going to gamble that he's the easier Republican to beat and hope he wins the nomination. They think he's the worst option, and they're going to attack him from day one.
And President Trump didn't endorse him, technically, because he's not running, but said some encouraging things. So if he ran and if President Trump backed him, this could be an interesting primary in New Hampshire.
It is. And we have to remember that President Trump won the New Hampshire primary in 2016 by huge margins. I think it was like 30 or 40 points. So he's quite popular in the state. His endorsement would carry a great deal of weight, probably make it near impossible to beat Lewandowski. And so when he said he hoped he got in, he thought it would be great. That was a signal to the rest of the state's Republicans that if Lewandowski runs, he'll have the full support of the president.
Ginger, thanks as always for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
I've been talking to Ginger Gibson, political correspondent at Reuters. She joined us for our weekly look at the latest news in national politics. You can still let us know how you're feeling about the U.S. economy and the Wisconsin economy. With President Trump criticizing the Federal Reserve, the stock market bouncing around some last week, are you worried about a possible recession? What does a healthy economy look like to you? Are you feeling the impact of trade disputes in your job, your business, your community? Do you think that the federal government should be doing stuff, or the Federal Reserve, to prevent the risk of a recession? If so, what do you want to see happen? As always, you can email us, ideas@WPR.org, or express your thoughts concisely on Twitter. Tweet us at Central Time WPR. A Wisconsin family has been in the news this week because of an unusual salad fixing. The Glendale family had gotten a package of organic lettuce from a local grocery store. In the process of assembling their salad, they found a live frog. They caught the frog on cell phone video and plan to bring it and the lettuce back to the grocery store. The frog escaped, though, and is reportedly still at large. The grocery store chain responded online, quote, "These situations happen from time to time when organic products are involved. USDA-certified organic items must be free of synthetic additives and certain pesticides. Although rare, from time to time we do see insects and other small animals such as frogs make it through packaging with fresh produce items. In this instance, the customer returned the organic lettuce for an even exchange." Even, I guess, I'm assuming the lettuce for lettuce, not frog for frog. They would have to dig up another one. Now, on the one hand, yes, if I were unpacking produce and something, anything moved in it, I'd probably have a quick minor freak out. On the other hand, you know, it makes it look like the produce is pretty healthy. The frog was able to survive that whole time on this fresh lettuce. So it's kind of a seal of quality, if you think about it. No? You don't buy it? Okay. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.